Okay, good evening. This is Richard Clem coming to you from St. Paul, Minnesota today, live on March 22nd, or possibly later on in the podcast program. And tonight I'm presenting a program on the Introduction to Professional Malpractice. It's just a very brief overview of Minnesota law and, to a certain extent, the law of other states. In the area of professional malpractice by healthcare providers. Specifically at the end, we'll have a few kind of representative cases talking about professional malpractice in the dental context. But by and large, the same principles we talk about today will cover just about any healthcare provider, so a physician, or a dentist, or anybody providing healthcare services to an individual. And we start out kind of with a historical background. Because the way that medical negligence law has kind of evolved took kind of a little bit of a curious path. I know when I went to law school, and probably when many of you went to law school, you sat down in your first day of contracts class, and you thought you were going to be talking about contracts for selling, a ton of flour or 1,000 widgets or something like that. And lo and behold, you sit down in the very first class that you get on your very first day of contracts law was a case, and I don't even remember the name of the case, but it was colloquially known as the case of the hairy hand. Which was really a medical malpractice case. A physician promised his patient that he would have a completely positive outcome at the end of the surgery, and lo and behold, the outcome was not 100% positive, and the patient wound up suing him. One of the kind of an early medical malpractice case, I think from sometime in the 1800s or so. And that case always seemed kind of out of place in the contracts case book, because I thought contracts meant things like, buying and selling of things. But here it was in the middle of fickle malpractice case. Many of the early medical malpractice cases were based upon contract. In fact, to a certain extent, they might still be that way. If the treating healthcare provider ever says anything along the lines of I promise you will have a good outcome to your surgery, and they don't deliver a perfect outcome, then that's a breach of contract, and the patient can sue because the healthcare provider did not perform the terms of the contract. Well, most astute doctors and dentists and other healthcare providers have figured out that it's probably not a good idea to say to your patient, "I absolutely promise a good outcome," because they realize that there are many litigious patients out there and many attorneys running around, and they realize quite correctly that it's probably not a good idea to say that. So you don't see too many cases of medical malpractice based upon contract, but that theoretically is still out there. But historically, most of the medical malpractice cases were actually a type of battery, is how they were viewed, because battery is an intentional tort. If you think of battery as me walking up to you and punching you, I have committed a battery. But a battery doesn't necessarily have to be quite that dramatic, because a battery is defined as any unwanted touching of another person. So if you touch another person and they did not consent to be touched, that constitutes a battery. So historically, most medical negligence cases started out as a battery case, because obviously if you're a treating healthcare provider, at some point you are going to be touching the patient. Well, obviously, though, in most cases, the patient is going to be consenting to being touched, because that's after all why they walked into the office in the first place, because they wanted treatment. so there's consent to it, but the early cases recognize, well, the consent has to be, you're not consenting to any kind of touching, you're consenting to some particular thing. So one early case here that's cited in the materials from 1908, I think, was the Moore case, and a pretty easy case. The patient was suing because the surgery to his ear or to her ear didn't come out the way she expected. Well, the doctor said, "Well, yeah, but it's a battery case," and the patient consented to it. But the court said, "Well, no, the patient consented to you operating on her left ear, you started operating on the right ear. So obviously that consent did not apply." So obviously in a pretty extreme case like that, you probably didn't have to go to law school to know that if the doctor operated on the left ear and it was the right ear that you came in to have the operation on, that's probably a pretty strong case. But that's what medical negligence was, for the large part. It was a form of battery. Well, this 1977 Minnesota case, Kornfeld, recognizes, well, we've kind of progressed beyond that, however. And because what they recognized in that case was the related tort of negligent non-disclosure. Because here, he said, well, you have the patient consented to this, but would the patient have consented to that if you had fully disclosed the risk of this procedure that you were going to undertake, or in the alternative, if you would have, there were alternative ways of doing it. So yes, the patient consented to having this operation, but would the patient really have consented to that if you had explained to the patient that, well, this surgery isn't really necessary, there's something else we could do that is a lot less invasive. So that was kind of the beginning. It was recognized in that case in 1977. I think it was probably similar remedies were probably applied in the lower courts even before the Minnesota Supreme Court recognized it then. But that was kind of the evolution from battery to negligence. So occasionally today you will still see some cases based upon negligent non-disclosure. If in a case of negligent non-disclosure, the plaintiff has to prove four things. First of all, the plaintiff, as in any negligence case, there are really four elements of a negligence cause of action that a plaintiff has to prove in order to prevail. First of all, there has to be a duty on the part of the defendant, and in the case of a negligent non-disclosure case, the duty is that the physician knows that there's a risk, knows either that there's a risk or that there's an alternative treatment plan that would work. So it boils down to whether the reasonable physician or reasonable dentist or reasonable surgeon would know of that risk and of that alternative plan. And furthermore, that they have a duty to disclose that to the patient. And that's a question basically not for the jury, whether or not this duty exists, but that's a duty for the court to establish whether that duty exists. And that boils down to whether a reasonable person in that physician's position would have known that there is that risk. There has to be a breach of that duty. The physician or dentist or healthcare provider did not disclose that information. As in any negligence case, there has to be causation. It can't just be in the abstract that the healthcare provider did something wrong. It has to be the cause of the plaintiff's injuries, and the plaintiff does have to have injuries. There have to be damages. So those are the elements of a negligent non-disclosure claim. That, however, has continued to evolve even more. And in this 1983 case of Reinhardt, The Minnesota Supreme Court went on to say, to make clear, that there's also just a plain old negligence claim. We can kind of stop worrying about this this old jurisprudence about battery, and it really just is the same as any case of negligence. But there is a twist when we come to medical negligence that we'll have to address. In this Reinhart case, the Minnesota Supreme Court explains what the four elements, the four things that the plaintiff needs to prove to prove their case. There has to be a standard of care recognized by the medical community that's applicable to that healthcare provider's conduct. The plaintiff has to show that the defendant departed from that standard. They have to show that it was a direct cause of their injuries, and there have to be damages. Now, one thing that the Minnesota Supreme Court has made clear from the outset is that in this area, almost invariably, the plaintiff needs to have a certain amount of expert testimony to establish their case. And as we will see, that part of the medical malpractice case will become even more important when we see how the legislature has gotten involved in it. But even from the get-go, from this 1983 case and probably cases earlier than that, the plaintiff must generally introduce expert testimony to establish the standard of care, and they also have to introduce expert testimony to show that the physician departed from that standard of care. And that's different from most other negligence cases. In a car accident or a slip and fall, you don't have to introduce expert testimony saying the defendant was driving too fast for the condition. Or you probably don't have to introduce expert testimony saying that there was a duty to clear the snow off the sidewalk, which I guess we're going to get tomorrow. Most negligence cases do not require expert testimony. And there are probably some, there might be some medical negligence cases that do not require expert testimony, such as operating on the wrong ear. So if you, doc, I need an operation on my left ear and the doctor does an operation on the right ear, maybe you don't need expert testimony in that case. Although I think the wise plaintiff's attorney probably would make sure that they did have that just to be on the safe side. But in almost any other case, the plaintiff's attorney has to keep in mind that before I even bring this case, and we'll see why you have to do it even before you bring it in a little bit in Minnesota, but almost any medical negligence case is going to require expert testimony. And we'll be talking about that more later on. But I just wanted to stress here that even from the earliest cases talking about it, even on these earlier negligent non-disclosure cases, the Supreme Court made clear that expert testimony was probably necessary. And like I say, we will discuss that a little bit more. So in any event, those in any negligence case, particularly a medical negligence case, those are the four elements that the plaintiff has to prove in order to establish their case. They have to show that there was some kind of duty that this doctor had. They have to show that duty was breached. They have to show that that breach of the duty was the cause. And we could study for months on what exactly we mean when we say cause. We'll just leave it with the words that the Minnesota Supreme Court uses, the direct cause, or what courts in some states call the proximate cause. It has to be a direct cause, and there have to be damages. So just because a provider committed some kind of egregious error, that in itself does not entitle anybody to sue. People can sue only if they experience damages. And at this point, I will give our first of several code numbers. So once again, whether you're taking the program live tonight or if you're listening to the podcast, our first code number is A47. A47. A is an alpha, 47 is the first code number for tonight's program. Well, as I mentioned, the four elements, the first of the four elements is that there has to be a duty, and that has to be breached. So what is that duty? Well, first of all, I will start by saying what the duty is not. In just about any state, the general rule, we would start by saying, although there might be so many exceptions that it will swallow up the rule, but the general rule is that just because somebody is seeking treatment does not impose a duty. So if somebody walks into a physician's office or a dentist's office saying, I have all these things wrong with me, please heal me. The provider is in general within their right simply to say, no, I don't want to heal you, go away. But if you are a physician or a dentist or any other kind of healthcare provider, I wouldn't rely too much upon that rule because there might be so many exceptions that kind of swallow up the rule. But in general, there has to be, you have to have some kind of relationship with the patient. So, for example, one case I have cited here from 1989, I believe was one where something was citing a I guess it's citing this Third Circuit case, a federal case from out east, kind of highlighting that rule where a mother brought her child to the emergency room, and while at the emergency room, apparently the son was treated just fine and did well. But the mother fainted right there in the emergency room. Well, the Third Circuit in that case, or the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, I guess, in this Sachs v. Thomas Jefferson Hospital said, well, no, the mere fact that you just happened to be in the emergency room does not impose any duty of care. So just because you fainted in the doctor's office does not mean that the doctor has to stop and treat you. There has to be a physician-patient relationship. Now, like I say, there might be exceptions to that, so I would be very skeptical of a healthcare provider prevailing upon that because there might be so many exceptions. Because the courts make clear, and cite a New York case on this point, that even a very cursory contact with somebody might establish the physician-patient relationship. So in that case, when the mother faints in the emergency room, if the doctor comes over and says, are you okay? Well, at that point, it might be a physician-patient relationship. And there might be other duties of care. For example, under federal law, and it's kind of outside the scope of this program, but under federal law, certainly in emergency rooms, I think that Pennsylvania case probably would have decided differently these days, but certainly an emergency room and probably other contexts where somebody presents themselves for treatment, there might be a duty for the physician to treat them even though there was no pre-existing patient relationship. And in addition, Minnesota, like many other states, has a Good Samaritan law. And when we mention the Good Samaritan law, we often think in terms of, it's a shield against liability. If you come upon somebody who is injured and you try in good faith to render aid to them, and you, in the course of doing that, you commit some minor act of negligence, well, generally they can't sue because the Good Samaritan law is a shield of liability. But in addition to that shield of liability, as quoted here, the Minnesota Good Samaritan law says that you do have a duty to assist people who are experiencing grave physical harm. So if you see somebody experiencing grave physical harm, whether or not you're a doctor or anything else, you are required to provide a certain level of assistance to them if you can do so without harm to yourself. And in most cases, that duty is satisfied by calling 911 and reporting it to the police or medical personnel. But possibly even in the case of a healthcare provider, it would not be inconceivable that a court would look at that statute and say, well, you do have that duty, and you breached that duty. So potentially, that might give rise to liability. But in general, you don't have a duty to treat somebody who's not currently a patient, although there might be many exceptions to that. Your other duty, though, is that once you do undertake to provide treatment to somebody, you have to use due care. You have to be careful. You have to act as a reasonable physician or reasonable healthcare provider would. But on the other hand, you are not liable for an unavoidable accident. Unless, like that hapless doctor that we learned about in our first day of law school, you promise the patient a good outcome, you're certainly not responsible for a perfect outcome in every single case. So you are not liable for an unavoidable accident. On the other hand, some accidents that you might be liable for under something called res ipsa loquitur. And res ipsa loquitur is one of the few times that the attorneys still speak Latin. It means that the thing speaks for itself. So there might be some cases where we infer that there is negligence, even though we can't point to the one thing that caused the negligence. But on the other hand, a doctor is not liable for unavoidable accidents. So there's kind of a fine line between those two propositions that was addressed in this Stearns case, Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 1992, where they recognized that, the mere fact that there is an accident, the mere fact that this patient did not have a good outcome, that does not imply negligence, but the jury might be able to find negligence if res ipsa loquitur applies. And for that to apply, it can't just be any old accident. It has to be the kind of accident that does not normally happen in the absence of negligence, that the whatever instrumentality of that accident was in the defendant's exclusive control. There's no evidence that it was actually caused by a third party. If all of those elements are met, if it's the kind of accident that doesn't normally happen in the absence of negligence, that the instrumentality that caused it, whether it be the scalpel or the anesthesia mask or whatever, if that instrumentality was always under the defendant's control, and there's no evidence that some third party, some unknown third party contributed to it, well, then the jury can find negligence under the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur, and the defendant will not be able to say simply that, it was an unavoidable accident. So it's kind of a fine line of what that duty is. In that 1992 case, the Minnesota Court of Appeals said that those were not contradictory, those two concepts. And at this point, I will go ahead and give our next code number. And the second code number for tonight's program is B91. B as in Bravo, 9-1. B91 is our second code word. B91. Well, as I mentioned before, expert testimony is almost always required in medical negligence cases. So let's take a look at that a little bit more. For example, this another case from 1972, the Silver case cited in the materials here, states that we, the Minnesota Supreme Court, have repeatedly held, so it goes back even further than that, that in order to prove negligence in a malpractice case, the plaintiff must offer expert medical testimony both to the standard of medical care and establish that the defendant physician departed from that standard. So it's in almost every medical negligence case, the case will get dismissed unless the plaintiff has an expert witness, namely another doctor of that same specialty, who is prepared to say, no, the standard for physicians to use, the standard for dentists in doing this kind of procedure, or the standard for cardiologists in this kind of procedure is to do A, B, and C. And I reviewed the medical records, and this doctor did not meet those standards. That is almost invariably required, the need for expert testimony. These other cases hold the same. I guess I have a little bit repetitive information here. But that will result in a dismissal. So in this Smith case from 1979, the Minnesota Supreme Court said that the plaintiff did not call any independent medical witness. He instead simply tried to cross-examine the defendant to get him to admit guilt, which did not happen. And in the absence of that independent medical testimony, the case was thrown out. Now, maybe he didn't have that expert testimony because no expert would have been willing to testify that way. But it makes clear that even an otherwise meritorious case without that expert testimony, will not prevail. So again, the main thing you should take away from this in our very cursory look at medical negligence tonight is that expert testimony is almost always required. That's certainly in Minnesota, probably in most other states as well, because that's a pretty overarching principle that we see in most other states. Well, similarly, as I mentioned, the first two elements of a negligence case are that there's a duty and that duty was breached. The third element is that that breach of duty was what caused the injuries. There has to be causation. There has to be direct cause, or what some states would call approximate cause. And there, once again, we could talk for hours and hours and hours on what exactly the word cause means. Because it's a pretty hard to define term, but the main thing to remember is that on the on causation as well, expert testimony is probably necessary, which was discovered by the hapless Mr. Silver in his case Silver versus Redlier. A Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1972, and here he simply did not establish the expert testimony. He did not establish with expert testimony that there was causation, that the doctor's negligence, even though it might have been proven, was what caused his injury. So again, expert testimony there as well. The final element we're not going to talk too much about tonight is damages. That might be an area where the expert testimony is not necessary, but even there, it might be necessary to establish that the plaintiff was indeed actually injured. That might be an area where expert testimony is also necessary. But those are the four elements of it. Now, what I've said up until now, again, we're discussing mostly Minnesota case law, but pretty much everything I've said up until this point is probably equally true in other states, probably with a little bit different twist here and there, but that's pretty established law elsewhere. Now what I'm going to be talking about is more or less specific to Minnesota, but you will find similar principles in other states as well. Because Well, every so often, the rightly or wrongly, I guess we can debate the merits of that question. But rightly or wrongly, every few years, the legislature seems to take up the question of whether or not there is a malpractice crisis going on in the state. If they conclude that there is a malpractice crisis going on, they will take steps to alleviate that crisis. And different states respond to that crisis in a different way. But one way that that's been done in Minnesota and a few other states is by something called an affidavit of expert review. And in reality, I think the Minnesota approach has actually worked out fairly well, because in general, the purpose of this affidavit of expert review statute is to kind of serve as a gatekeeper function. There's a feeling, I don't know whether it's right or wrong, but there was a feeling that people were just bringing these malpractice cases left and right, even in cases where there was clearly no negligence, and the doctors were settling cases just so that these nuisance cases would go away. So there was thinking, well, what can we do to keep these nuisance cases from even making their way to court? And what the Minnesota legislature came up with, and it's been around for at least 25 years in Minnesota, is MnStat 145.682, which requires two affidavits be filed in any given case. And this applies to any action against a healthcare provider for bad outcomes in healthcare, basically medical malpractice cases. But the term healthcare provider is defined as being a physician, surgeon, dentist, or other healthcare professional, or a hospital, including the people who assist them and so forth. So it's pretty broad. So any kind of healthcare professional malpractice case is going to be governed by this statute. And the thinking of the legislature was to keep these nuisance suits, that there was a perception that there were too many of them, to keep those nuisance suits at bay. The legislature imposed a requirement that prior to filing a lawsuit, the attorney had to put in an affidavit under oath that he or she consulted with an expert witness who would potentially be able to testify at trial to say that, yes, there was negligence in this case. And the thinking was that if the attorney, rather than just going off half-cocked and bringing the lawsuit, you have to make sure that there's at least one expert witness who's willing to testify. And I just realized they didn't give the third code number. So the third code number for tonight's program is C57. C as in Charlie, 5-7. C57 is the third code number. C57 is our third code number. And let's just walk through the statute. Subdivision 1 is just the definition. And subdivision 2 says that exactly when these two affidavits have to be filed. It says the affidavit under subdivision 3 has to be served upon the defendant along with the summons and complaint. So as soon as you start the case, you can't just hand a doctor a summons in a civil lawsuit. You have to hand them a summons, a complaint, and an affidavit saying that I, the attorney, have reviewed the facts of this case with an expert, and I think expert's qualifications will reasonably be accepted by the trial court. In other words, that expert will reasonably be allowed to testify at trial. And in my expert's opinion, I don't have to say who the expert was yet, But I have to say that I really did talk to a physician or a dentist or an anesthesiologist or whatever specialty we're talking about, and that person would be willing to testify that one or more of the defendants in this case was negligent. So in other words, I can't simply file a case anymore in a medical malpractice case thinking that, well, maybe we'll be able to prove that the doctor was negligent. I can still do that in a car accident case. You know, if I, you know, if you were driving down the road, you know, just, you know, using, you know, just an overabundance of caution and the accident wasn't your fault, well, I can still sue you and we'll let the judge sort it out. But in the medical negligence case, I have to say, no, I have already talked to an expert and I have the case, all, ready to, take to trial and I have this expert. Will testify that there's negligence. And I have to do that at the time I commence the complaint. And there's an exception that if the injured plaintiff hobbles into my office the day before the statute of limitations is about to run out, then there's an exception. I can file that affidavit, I think, 60 days later. But in general, we have to file that affidavit, right from the very beginning. I can't even start the case until I can testify under oath that, yes, I talked to an expert about it. So that's part one of the statute. And then part two of the statute is, well, eventually you have to tell them who that expert is. So the statute calls for a second affidavit signed by both you, the attorney, and the healthcare provider, or the expert witness, so the, you know, your expert witness dentist, or your expert witness chiropractor, or your expert witness anesthesiologist. You know, the expert in the defendant's field. You know, somebody pretty much in the same specialty, as we will see, as the person you are suing. At that point, basically, I think the calendar gets a little bit more complicated, but basically, within 6 months after beginning the case, within about 180 days, you know that you are going to have to not only say that, yes, I have this anonymous expert out there, but you're going to have to identify that person, and that expert is going to have to sign the affidavit saying, here is the basis for my opinion. I think the defendant in this case was negligent because he did this procedure without doing this test first. And there has to be a certain level of specificity. And as you see, if you read the remainder of this statute, you'll see that, well, what happens if you don't file that case, if you don't file that affidavit? Well, the statute pretty much says that if you don't file that affidavit, your case is going to get thrown out. Now, there are, you know, it says here, well, you know, the court for good cause, you know, in its discretion can say that, you know, it's okay that your affidavit was a little bit late or that your affidavit wasn't perfect or something. But from reading the cases construing this, it makes clear that the courts are very reluctant to say that. So if you are a plaintiff's attorney bringing a medical malpractice action in Minnesota, you better be very careful to make sure that you comply scrupulously with that statute, because in general the courts do not give that leeway, even though I suppose in a particular hardship kind of situation they might do so, but you really can't count on that. So that the language in the statute saying that, well, the court can dispense with that requirement in certain limited situations, well, they really are very limited. Now, that statute is kind of unique in Minnesota. As far, I'm not familiar with any other state statute involving wording things the same way. I do have a link here in the course materials kind of digesting the similar requirements in other states. So there might be some statute in your state that covers the subject. But I noticed looking through that list, as far as I can tell, neither Wisconsin nor Iowa have similar requirements. as far as an affidavit of expert review. In this region anyway, that's kind of unique to Minnesota. And at this point, I'm going to give our fourth code number of the evening. I'll write down the time here, too. The fourth code number is D91. D as in Delta 91. D91 is the fourth code number for tonight's program. So like I say, as far as I know, neither Iowa nor Wisconsin have that affidavit expert review requirement. I did note that Iowa does have a statute relating to expert testimony in medical malpractice cases or cases against dentists. I have that linked in the material. I don't think that departs too much from what the Minnesota Rules of Evidence would have to say about it, but it is a subject at least addressed by the Iowa legislature, but not in as much detail as Minnesota. So that's kind of a unique provision to Minnesota law, this affidavit of expert review. One area though that I'm sure all 50 states have a statute of limitations. There's a limited time in which you can sue somebody for malpractice. And other states will certainly have similar statutes of limitations. The number of years, though, will vary considerably, though, so you will want to check your own statute. Traditionally, I guess if I had to give a general rule, I would say that in general, the statute of limitation in most states is 2 years for suing somebody for negligence, and it's usually 6 years when you sue somebody for contract. That's kind of where most state legislatures have kind of come down, although there's so many exceptions to that. But if you need a majority rule, I guess I would say 2 years for tort cases or negligence cases, 6 years for contract cases. So if I had to guess, I would say probably most statutes of limitations in other states are probably 2 years because mostly they're contract cases. Well, what if you didn't sue within 2 years. So we're going to, go back to that first day of law school and, the case of the hairy hand, and we're going to say, well, this is really a contract case. In some states, maybe you could do that. You could extend the statute of limitations to 6 years, but not in Minnesota. You can't do that in Minnesota because the Minnesota statute of limitation quoted here is any action against a physician, surgeon, dentist, occupational therapist, or other care provider defined in so-and-so statute. And any action by a patient or former patient alleging malpractice, error, mistake, failure to care, whether based on contract or tort, has to be filed within 4 years. So in Minnesota, the statute of limitations on a negligence action, or not a negligence action, a malpractice action, even if it's in contract, is 4 years. You can sue somebody after 4 years. And then there's a little bit of an exception, I guess, if you're a doctor and you're suing for your bill, you want to keep this next provision in mind because you might, if you sue for the money that's owed to you from treating the patient, well, then maybe they can still bring it as a counterclaim even though the time has already run. So 4 years, that's pretty easy the way the statute's written, and that's not too hard to comprehend. But it makes it, well, it gets a little bit more difficult when you stop to consider the question of, well, when does the clock start to run? 4 years from when? And that's a subject of, or can be a subject of quite a bit of litigation. And before we talk about that litigation, I'll give you the next code number here. I've written down a different spot here, so I want to keep track of it. Our next code number for this this program is E21. E is in Echo 21. E21 is the, I guess that's fifth code word. So when does the clock start to run? 4 years from when? We'll start off by saying what it's not 4 years from. Well, I guess I'll tell you what it is. It's 4 years from the day that you could first bring that lawsuit. So if you were entitled to bring the lawsuit, if you felt like it, you could have brought the lawsuit on January 1st, 2012. Well, then the clock started on January 1st, 2012, because that's the first day you could have sued. And the time ran out on January 1st, 2016, because then, or I don't know, it was December 31st, I don't know. But the time ran out 4 years from the time when you could first sue. And in many cases, that's very clear when you could first sue. You could first sue when you, you know, you discovered that the doctor operated on the wrong ear. You know, that's pretty clear-cut case. But it's not always quite so clear-cut case. Because in some other areas, not medical malpractice, but in some other areas, the courts will follow what is called the discovery rule. So the clock doesn't start to run. The clock doesn't start on the day when the injury occurred. The clock starts to run on the day that you discovered the injury. So in other words, if you were driving, you know, you were careening negligently down the street and you crashed into my car, and I was on vacation, you know, then I get home after vacation and I discover that you crashed into my car, well, then the clock would probably start to run then, because the clock starts to run when I discovered the cause of action, or at least when I reasonably should have discovered it. But Minnesota, and that might be the rule in some contexts, but in Minnesota anyway, it is not the rule when it comes to professional malpractice against a healthcare provider. And the Minnesota courts make that very clear, that the mere fact that you did not discover your injury, well, that's your problem. You should have tried harder to discover your injury. The clock started running the day that you got your injury, not the day that you discovered it. But you know, that might be a little bit of a difficult rule to apply, though, because sometimes it's a fine line between saying, you know, I discovered my injury today, or saying my injury didn't really start until today. So in other words, in a context, something like, a doctor negligently gives you some drug that causes some disease 10 years later. Well, you can't sue the doctor just because he gave you the wrong drug immediately, because you don't have any damages. You have to wait until you have damages until you can actually sue. So in that context, the time when you can first sue would not be back when the malpractice was committed, but the later time, not when you discovered the injury, but when the injury first started. And that's kind of a difficult rule to apply. Because it sounds a little bit like the discovery rule. And that's discussed here in this Broke case, where the Minnesota Court of Appeals made clear that it was not going to adopt a discovery rule. But on the other hand, the court held in this case, it was not a case of that the plaintiff did not discover their injury. It's that they did not have any injury. Because here, I guess it was a medical negligence case, and the plaintiff suffered a cardiac arrest as a result of the negligence, but they didn't have the cardiac arrest until a few years after the malpractice took place. So until they had that cardiac arrest, it wasn't a matter of them discovering anything. They just didn't have any damages. So it can be a fine line. I mean, that's pretty clear. Obviously, if you're feeling fine one day and you have a heart attack the next day, you didn't really have any damages until you had the heart attack. But on the other hand, if you if you had this injury that some internal injury that you didn't know about, well, you still had an injury. And then if the day you discovered it would not be a new injury, it would simply be a discovery. So that can be kind of a fine line in those cases. Excuse me, I just have to get some water here. I'm just going to check my email real quick here. I've checked it a couple of times just to see if anybody has any questions, and I'm not seeing any. So that's kind of a very broad overview of medical and dental and other healthcare malpractice cases in Minnesota. Just to wrap up here in the remaining few minutes, I just took a few representative cases from the dental area, just to see how some of these principles would be applied in particular cases. And as you see, the hot issues, this is certainly not an exhaustive list of all malpractice cases in the state, but probably a fairly representative example. And as you can see, the kind of the hot button issues in many of these cases are the statute of limitations and expert testimony and that need to have an affidavit of expert testimony. Looking at the statute of limitations, another issue of when the statute of limitations begins to run is, what if it's kind of a continuing course of conduct or course of treatment where the plaintiff is going to this dentist maybe there was some negligent, maybe there was some continuing negligence that took place, but they're talking about something that happened 5 years ago, but after that incident 5 years ago, they continued to go to this dentist. That dentist continued to treat them. They kept going to them for follow-up care, and that's what happened in this case of this Rindall case. In that case, the court held that the statute of limitations began to run on the last date that the plaintiff went to the dentist for follow-up care. So it was not necessarily the date of that earlier negligence. But what they did say was that it was not the later date but what happened in this case, the plaintiff was had some bad outcome during their dental treatment. They continued going to that dentist for follow-up care, and then for whatever reason they were not seeing that same dentist, but they had a prescription from the dentist, and they went to the pharmacy to refill that prescription. And the issue in that case was whether their going to the pharmacy to renew that prescription constituted continuing follow-up care, because the pharmacy called the dentist and said, we have this expired prescription. Is it okay for us to refill it? And the dentist said, yes, you can go ahead and renew that prescription. Well, in that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court said, no, that was not enough treatment on that later date. Because that prescription, that was less than 4 years ago. No, simply that contact between the dentist and the pharmacy, when the dentist didn't even see the patient, that was not enough to start the clock running anew. At the latest, it would have been the date that the person returned for follow-up care. And in general, that last date of over a continuing course of treatment is going to be the date when the statute of limitations starts to run, the four-year clock starts going. Unless, as discussed in the Doyle case, there was an earlier single act. So if there was some clear single act of negligence 5 years ago, well, the mere fact that you're continuing to see this this same dentist that continuing course of conduct will not perpetually revitalize the statute of limitations for that negligence that happened a long time ago. So that discusses, I think they held in this case that the single act exception would not apply. But they discuss whether or not the clock would start anew based upon that single act. Well, and again, the other hot button issue, and especially it looks like on some of these more recent cases, because these are from 2014, some of them, that question of expert testimony and compliance with that Minnesota expert affidavit statute. Now, for those of you in other states, the discussion of the ad isn't too relevant to you, but the discussion of the expert testimony probably is, because our rules of evidence on expert testimony are probably pretty similar to yours. So the same general principles would apply. For example, the Anderson case, the case got thrown out because it was a lawsuit against a dentist and the plaintiff was alleging that, well, the negligence in this case was that when you did this extraction, you should have given me a prescription for an antibiotic because I got some infection after this extraction, you should have been alert to that possibility, and you should have written me a prescription for some antibiotic that would have kept that from happening. Well, the case got thrown out, and I don't know whether their case was meritorious or not, but it got thrown out because they didn't have their expert witness ducks in a row, because they got the affidavit of expert review was from a general practice dentist, and he said, yes, whenever I do an extraction, I always, give them an antibiotic, and that's what every other state does, and that's, is clearly a breach of duty, is what that was what the expert witness was willing to testify. But the court threw it out because they said, well, but you didn't really prove causation, because how do we know that this disease the person suffered had any connection to that? So again, just to show how seriously the courts take that requirement for expert testimony, I should have had a physician to be able to testify that causation. I think this infection was caused by the extraction, and an antibiotic would have prevented it. But they didn't have that expert available, so their case got tossed out. What qualifications does your expert have to have? We learned that in this Christescu case. The plaintiff was suing her dentist for malpractice, and she happened to have she had moved to the United States. She was originally from Romania, and she was a dentist back in Romania. So she thought her American dentist committed malpractice, so she sued, she didn't have an outside expert to testify in the case, because she said, well, I'm an expert. I'm a dentist. But the Minnesota Court of Appeals threw that case out, because they said, no, you can't, not because you're disinterested, they did not say you have to be a disinterested witness or anything like that. If she had been an American dentist, well, maybe the case would have come out differently. But they said, well, no, you never attended any American dental school, and you don't have the qualifications to testify as to the standard of care of an American dentist. So probably your dentist has to be, your expert witness probably has to be either licensed in this state or certainly qualified to be licensed in this state. You can't just get some international expert to testify. And then in conclusion, this last case, they've just held that the general practitioner dentist was testified as to the able to testify as to the duty of care, even though it involved maybe theoretically they should have brought in a radiologist to testify how you should mark the X-rays, but in that case they let it slip. Well, anyway, that does bring us up to the hour. Our final code number for the evening is F as in Fox 07. F07 is our final code word. So thank you for attending. Those of you taking the podcast, check the instructions on my website, but email me those same code numbers. If you have questions, want to see information about future programs, you can visit my website at richardclem.com.